Thank you, and welcome back. You're listening to Policy and Pino on Rhode Island Public Radio in concert with the beautiful Providence Athenaeum. Joining me are communications consultant Bill Fisher, Providence City Councilor Nieva LaFortune, a Democrat, and two-time legislative candidate Louis Vargas, a Republican, who has done outreach for the Rhode Island Republican Party. We're talking about political narrative in the Twitter era. I'd like to go back to 2011. It seems like a long time ago in some ways, but it was kind of a significant moment for Twitter because that's when the so-called Arab Spring happened, and it was seen as a way for citizens to kind of broadcast their own message to the world and get around a tyrannical or repressive government. And even here in Rhode Island at the State House, I think there was a lawmaker or two who tweeted something from inside a closed Democratic caucus, and it was seen kind of as a kind of a radical new moment in political communication in Rhode Island. Louis Vargas, you're a young guy. You've grown up basically with Twitter and social media. Do you see a big upside to Twitter?
Absolutely. The platform allows you to spread your message out in a way that nobody can really censor. And there's no other parallel to it. I mean, Facebook is same thing, social media platform that allows you to post basically whatever you like. And the great thing about that is that if it's a view that's unpopular, people are going to reject it, and people are going to show that it's unpopular and react to it a certain way. And I think that's the best thing that you could possibly have, even in regards to public officials, because you want to know exactly what they're thinking. You want to be able to react to the real public official, whenever it's related to a public policy decision, not a facade that they put out in public. So I think that Twitter and social media is great. It allows you to get the reaction of a person right when an event happens, like the Arab Spring or any political event, really.
Nieva LaFortune, you're relatively new to politics. You've been in office a relatively short time. How does Twitter fit into your toolkit as an elected official? Do you really see it as a way to communicate with your constituents and your Rhode Islanders, or is it more just around the margins as something that people have to do nowadays?
Well, you have to use multiple platforms when communicating your message and when you're reaching out to your constituents. And I just wanted to quickly go back to your previous comments about Arab Springs. I think that was a glimpse of what was happening in a world outside of our own. And I think for many people who are not privileged, who don't have access to media or print, this was a way for people to really show the world what was going on in their communities. And our major media companies weren't in control of that. And for me, as a Haitian American, I think growing up, the only media I saw about my country was the poorer communities, was the destruction or the political turmoil. But you really didn't hear about the beauty or the things, the positive things that were going on. For me now, as an elected official, I think it's really important, as I said previously, to use multiple platforms because you're also engaging with people from different backgrounds. You're engaging with people in various age groups. And as you've mentioned earlier, people have different forms of gaining their information. So it's important to share news or information via Twitter, via a newsletter, via Facebook. But I think you can't solely depend on one or the other.
Bill Fisher, to what extent does Twitter change the political equation in Rhode Island? I mean, critics would say at the State House, power is a very hierarchical structure. So does it really change things or give a way for critics of the status quo to talk back?
I'm not sure it changes the power structure in any way, shape, or form. What it's done is, and I agree with my two colleagues here, I see good and bad in it. Right, I'm 50 years old. I went to college without a computer. Right, the internet was just starting to crank. I didn't have an email account. I've been on Twitter for 9 years. It is a valuable news feed for me in my profession. I can see exactly what reporters are working on. It is a valuable tool to get a message out very quickly, particularly in times of crisis, or to correct misinformation. The downside I see is the speed and the rapid response that comes without context. President Kennedy had 13 days to navigate the Cuban Missile Crisis without a 24-hour news cycle, without Twitter, without the omnipresent chatter of, you know, 100 million Twitter users or whatever the number is. And I think we're losing that. I think the news cycle speeds up. When I managed Sheldon Whitehouse's AG campaign in 1998, we'd get a question. We'd answer it. It would be in the Providence Journal in the morning. We had an opportunity to digest our strategy. I think we're starting to move a little too quickly sometimes for our own good.
Some great points from our panel, and I have a confession to make. I am a Twitter addict. I'm powerless under the force of those 140 characters, sometimes 280 characters now. And for me, it's really a great way to get my journalism out. You know, when I first was introduced to Twitter, I thought, what can you really say in 140 characters? But, of course, you can include a link to a much longer article or story, so it can be a way for conveying in-depth reporting as well. It's also a really valuable tool for finding out what other reporters are doing in Rhode Island. When I'm at work, I use something called TweetDeck, where I have five columns of tweets, and I monitor that constantly, and I read the tweets that interest me that have happened when I've been sleeping. And, you know, my wife tries to tell me news stops when I go home, and it's really not so. But I am given pause, like Bill and members of our panel, about some elements of social media. And I think one of the things that is abundantly clear, but that we forget sometimes, is how we, the users of social media, are creating all the content. Where would Mark Zuckerberg be without us posting our cat photos or photos of our kids in Little League or what have you on Facebook? And we're creating the content for Twitter as well. So, Nirva LaFortune, have the gods of social media found a way to just make us capitalize on our own narcissism?
I'm glad you got that one first.
Or if you want to come at it a different, I mean, obviously there's good and bad to any technology, but does it give you pause that we're that the expectation on Facebook is that we're constantly expected to put ourselves out there, put the sunny side of our lives out there? And how is that affecting the way we view life?
What I was thinking is we're putting our framed self out there. It's not necessarily our true self. So to be honest, I did not start really tweeting until this campaign. I was trying to avoid Twitter for the longest. In fact, I remember I had to ask a high school kid how to tweet. Because I didn't know. And when I went to college, my freshman year of college, I still remember Netscape Navigator, trying to log via AOL online, and I didn't have a computer. I didn't have a cell phone when I went to college. So I think it gives people a platform. It gives people a voice. I think it's framed. So I think it's really important for us as users and as people who are viewing the content to understand that it may not be real. And we're only getting one side of the story. So again, it's really important for us to vet the information or take it for face value.
How about that, Louis Fargas?
Yeah, I would largely echo her sentiment. I would say that our society has grown largely into an instant gratification society where we want to post the picture and we want all of our family to see it immediately and, you know, make the little smiley face. Or on Twitter, we want to say what our opinion is and then get people's reactions to it right away. Even in regards to interacting with public officials, we want to be able to tweet our president and have them respond to it or tweet, you know, the local celebrity or something like that. So I think it just goes as to what Bill was saying, not only the speed of the news cycle, but just like the speed of society in general. We want everything like that.
Bill Fisher, it seemed like there was somewhat of a change in Twitter growing that really took root in 2016, where we saw there was still a lot of good news and useful information, but there were also a lot of hateful people on Twitter, racists, anti-Semites, the so-called alt-right. And now some people have said Twitter really needs to focus more on cleaning its own house rather than experimenting with giving us more characters. Your thoughts on that?
You know, in the past couple of weeks, both the CEO of Twitter and Facebook talked about their own failings in the 2016 election, and the in the manner in which ads were purchased by interest outside of this country. This whole thing just happened very quickly, and we really didn't have a good talk about the rules of engagement and how it should all work. And now you have, I think it's Sheryl Sandberg from CEO and Zuckerberg from Twitter talking about their own failings and how they're going to try to put more controls into it. I think that's something that has to happen here, and I think part of the targeting I would do to try to police it a little more would be the anonymous accounts. One of my rules of engagement is not to engage with people who are hiding behind an anonymous account. But the anonymous accounts are read by members of the media. I represent the Superman building. It gets a lot of interest. I'll see an anonymous account posting facts about a particular piece of legislation. And then reporters will call me, and they'll be asking me about that misinformation. And so mainstream media, in many respects, is being driven by some of the false information that's out there. And that's one of the things that I think we all need to be cognizant of.
As Bill said, I think he made a good point that there are, Twitter does allow people to create anonymous accounts, and that sometimes encourages some really bad behavior. Facebook, you're supposed to use your real name. But there's someone who tweets in Rodan under the handle CoffeeBlackRI. I don't know who it is. It's someone who does it and who has a lot of insight about state government and who offers an insider's view while kind of being a freelance critic. And isn't there some value in that, Bill?
There's some value in it. But it can be problematic as well. It is driving media inquiries, and it is driving a narrative that sometimes is not accurate. And so, and you can't go to the person to correct it. You can't have a meaningful conversation and say, "I appreciate your insights. You're right 9 times out of 10. This is why you're wrong." And for me, you know, I've had very limited interaction with anonymous accounts. I just think you start to go down a road where it's not healthy dialogue.
Well, speaking of things that are problematic, we must touch on the issue of Russian interference in last year's election and the Russian messages being sent our way on Facebook. This is from a recent report by NPR, and this is a direct quote from the story. Moscow's intelligence agencies not only use secret cyber attacks to steal and leak information, as the U.S. intelligence community concluded, the Russians also openly bought ads on Facebook aimed at amplifying the most controversial issues in American life, including abortion, guns, and LGBT issues, and used fake accounts to spread disinformation and or even organize real-life rallies. I think most people who use Facebook are not using it for to get political information. The political news might be in the background. It seems more of a social thing where people highlight their vacation or their kids' Little League or something like that. So, Louis Vargas, how much of a concern that there's this kind of wallpaper that we might not even be aware of with Putin or his allies trying to influence what's going on in America?
Well, I think it's worrisome that it's happening, of course, but it's also not a new thing. Countries have tried to influence other countries' elections for, you know, decades. So while the means of doing that are changing, it shouldn't be surprising to us, I think, that it's happening. Though how to actually address it is a very complicated thing. I'm not sure I have an answer for that.
Nirva LaFortune, your thoughts on that?
I agree. It's challenging to address that issue because when you start policing, then what's going to happen is someone's going to create some sort of other Twitter or Facebook where they won't be policed. So does the responsibility fall on us to, again, vet those sources, to really think about the news that's coming in and to look at it, to form our own opinions rather than depend on others to shape our perspective? It's challenging, and it's really difficult for me to answer that question because it's this ongoing cycle. So you stop one, but someone creates another.
Bill Fisher, it seems very striking how when Ronald Reagan was president, he ran an ad about the Russian bear being in the woods, and it's a couple of decades on now, and it seems like there's a sharp partisan divide about Russia's intentions in the U.S. What are your thoughts on that in terms of how it hits on Facebook?
Well, I agree with everything that's been said already. There is a long history of government interference in elections. It's well documented. This is just a new medium that it is happening in. The problem with this medium is that it's happening much quicker, and I don't think everybody understands the relationship between a Facebook ad and the purchases you make on the internet and how you're tracked by large companies. I was looking for a pair of shoes the other day, and then I go on Facebook and the shoe ad is next to my screen, and I'm thinking that I'm being followed. I'm just trying to buy a pair of shoes, right? This is way beyond Russia, but this is the world we're living in. And you know, when you go on YouTube because you're looking up your favorite music video and there's an ad that comes out before that music video, that ad is with great purpose. It's based on your zip code. It's based on your Google searches. These things are all happening, and I don't think most of the general public really understands why they're seeing the ads they're seeing.
And is that just the way it is now, or is there, I think we're seeing a move toward more regulation of advertising on Facebook, political advertising. Where do you see this headed?
Well, the kind of cat's out of the bag a little bit, and even Zuckerberg was saying, you know, he had President Obama, I think it was a New York Times story, had reached out to him during the campaign to say, this is happening. And his response was, this is going to be really hard to fix. So we're not going to fix it here. But the advertising medium for campaigns, local and even statewide, it's cheap. Facebook ads are cheap. They're cheap. And it's an effective way to reach people. It's an effective tool. The problem is it can be used for good and bad. And I think we're just starting to really understand the depth of the bad right now.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Coming up, a look at what role social media will play in elections next year. I'm Ian Donis. You're listening to Policy and Pino on Rhode Island Public Radio, and we're recording in front of a live audience here at the Providence Athenaeum.